Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of 342 Productions. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how are you doing, sir?
What up, though?
What the? This ain't even a guest episode. What is this?
It's time to hoop it up.
Ah, I see. Okay, well, we are going abbreviated intro today. It would appear recording on a Wednesday afternoon instead of the Thursday, the early Thursdays we normally do. So I was going to miss the Wednesday slate in terms of any players that we may bring up on this podcast. But going to get into some news items. Had quite a bit happen on the injury front. Some fun stuff with Spo. Then we're going to dig into the Dunker Spot mailbag. So an early thank you to those who continue to send questions to us throughout the week. Again, you don't have to wait for a prompt. If you have random basketball thoughts at any time, email us at dunkerspot@yahoo.com. We will get to them, and we have some fun ones in store for you today. But first, let's get into some news items. The Miami Heat and Eric Spoelstra coming through with a bit of a bombshell. Yesterday, the Heat and Eric Spoelstra agreeing to an 8-year extension worth over $120 million, which is per the Woj story that came accompanied with the news. The most committed money in North American coaching history. To say well-deserved might be an understatement. Two titles for Spo, top 20 all-time in wins already, top 10 in playoff wins already. Continues to remake and mold teams in his image, get the most out of teams that don't have any business going as far as they do most of the time. He has been one of the best coaches in basketball for the last decade, conservatively. And I think he's firmly planted his flag as the best coach in basketball over the past few years. So props to Spo, first and foremost. Any early Spo thoughts?
Extremely well-deserved. One of the top coaches we've seen in the sport of basketball, and it looks like he's going to be a Heat lifer. So good to see not just the hashtag bag, but the amount of years for him. And you think about it, he's been with the Heat organization since like 1995, which is longer than some folks listening have been alive. So that's an accomplishment in itself. It's the league goes up and down, but he's been down there in Miami finding a way to get it done, getting the most out of his players. And it's been really fun to watch, and it's fun to see how that will continue to grow.
It's a nice check mark in the box of just organizational stability. Honestly, you mentioned starting in the video room in the 90s, and it's still been here. And I think back to when he first came to Miami, and me as just like young Heat fan still reeling from championship, what the heck is this first round exit? Oh my God, we lost all these games. What happened? And then it's like, wait, who is Eric Spoelstra when you're, you know, coming fresh off of like Pat Riley? Like, who is this? And I was like, okay, cool. And then you get the Big Three era. They start 9-8 and it's like, okay, there's a whole lot of noise. Is Pat Riley actually going to come back? And that proved to be like a real inflection point. But Pat Riley's like, nah, I'm not coming downstairs. I'm not replacing this dude. This is your coach. Figure it out. And that turns into two finals in 4 years. And just to see what the Heat have dealt with, the Chris Bosh situation, different iterations of the team, strikeouts, free agency, eventually getting Jimmy Butler in the building. Eric Spoelstra has been, he's been the constant. The fun stuff he's done defensively, the way that he has remade the offense multiple times over since he's been here. All of the countless like G League / journeyman stories that have come through Miami over the last few years with the way that Eric Spoelstra has been able to maximize guys in different roles. It's been incredibly fun to watch. And we've touched on this part, you know, going back briefly to the defense. We've touched on this through a few like mailbag questions throughout the history of the podcast when people are like, hey, what are you watching for on defense? How do you bunker down? What are your kind of key areas? And like growing up watching Miami as often as I have and watching Miami during the Spoelstra era in particular, I have learned so much about defense and concepts just by watching the Heat play every night because he does so many different things and puts so many different players in different spots. So it's been fun to just watch that for my own basketball mind growing purpose as well. But yeah, just he's there forever. Like the only other thought that I have really as it pertains to Spo is just like what happens like towards the end of the life of this contract. Like when does he, if ever, get the I want to be in the front office itch? If that comes to, I don't see him being anywhere else than Miami, period, for his basketball career. So I do wonder, do we eventually get like a transition period there to where Miami sees someone else on the coaching staff kind of grooming him to take over as head coach to kind of continue that pipeline of we are in-house, we build this here, and then we get coach, assistant coach here elevated, then Spo goes to the top, and then it just continues from there. So I'll keep an eye on that, but that's multiple years down the road at this point. But just all of the props in the world to Eric Spoelstra and Miami for getting this done. Very brief free agency thing. Hamidou Diallo, welcome back to the NBA. 10-day contract for the Washington Wizards, last seen in Detroit. He's been playing well in the G League, averaging around, 19-7 during G League play so far this year. Extremely fun athlete, good offensive rebounder, fun driver. Last time we saw him in the NBA anyway, really growing with the passing chops. I mean, the driving chops, rather. Flies around defensively, so curious to see like what that stint's going to look like in Washington as we get into 10-day contract season in the NBA. But then on the injury front, John Morant, surgery on his shoulder. He is now out for the year after he just got back, which ultimately stinks for the Memphis Grizzlies, though they did get a big win last night. Tyrese Halliburton took a nasty fall and split in a recent game, left the game, did not come back. Only a hamstring strain to be reevaluated in 2 weeks, so glad it wasn't worse than that. Misspoke on the last pod about Chris Paul, as they think it was a tweet that came out about him having surgery. Actually had the surgery on Monday, not over the weekend, as I stated on the last pod. But he's going to be reevaluated in 3 weeks, so keeping an eye on that in light of everything going on with Golden State and their rotation. Cade Cunningham suffered a knee injury, but he's going to be reevaluated in 7 to 10 days. And Jakob Poeltl twisted an ankle pretty badly before the Laker game, but he's going to be reevaluated in 2 weeks. Among these injuries, any team context you would like to talk through here?
All of them. Through all of them. I think number one, the John Morant one is tough. Obviously, if you're Memphis, you waited all that time for him to come back. He came back. He showcased what he can do for that team. You went 5-3 during that stretch. And just like that, not only is he back out, he's back out for the rest of the season. And so that go ahead and takes a hit. But when you look at it overall, Memphis is 11-10 on the road this year. I think they have 3 home wins. Ja or no Ja, if they have won some home games, this might be a different conversation. I mean, you're coming off a road trip where you beat the Lakers, Suns, and Mavericks. You're tied for second most road wins in the Western Conference. Minnesota has 12, just for context. But I think what this does is it just sets up an opportunity. I know it's probably going to be hashtag this is the lost season. I think this is an opportunity to remind yourself of exactly how tenuous the Western Conference can be and that there's no guarantees. Even as good as your core is, even as good as you have performed, you're going to have to be able to refine that formula. And so what do you need around Ja, Jaren Jackson, Desmond Bane, even hypothetically Marcus Smart, who hopefully he didn't hurt his finger too bad? Who is going to step up? Who do you need to move on from? So I think this is really going to become a evaluation type year. You found a Vince Williams. You know what he can do defensively, the energy he plays with. Can you find more from the guys that you have to have a clear vision of what you need and set yourself up for next season? I think is the biggest key there. Do you have any Memphis thoughts?
Not much more than what you talked on. I'm glad you brought up Vince Williams and how fun his season's been. Like, they've been giving David Roddy a lot more burn naturally with all the injuries they dealt with. Like, it definitely feels like a let's see what we have here type situation. I'm curious to see, like, how much more opportunity David Roddy gets, not just in terms of minutes, but what kind of usage he gets. Same thing with Zaire Williams, who's quietly been fun for this Memphis team this year as well. Bounce back from what we saw last season in terms of the on-ball usage. But just zooming out, though, it just kind of stinks that Memphis really hasn't been able to get off the ground just in terms of who's been available. So there will be some fun in figuring out like just the developmental portion of it and figuring out what you have and then kind of making the big move and making the big push next season. But it's just been a really weird year all around. And I also just wonder, I think this is more like fan angst and frustration more than anything. But like, I do wonder, like, from the top, does this affect how they view Taylor Jenkins' season at all? So, like, that's a thought in the back of my head. But ultimately, just get well soon, Ja. And we will see what this Memphis roster looks like, how they perform, close out the year, and what this roster is going to look like heading into next season.
I will point to beating Phoenix on the road without Ja and then beating Dallas without Ja and Jaren that there is still a level of buy-in. So hopefully they don't go too hard on the coaching aspect. But we know how things go these days, so that won't happen. To Indiana. I am honestly, it feels very weird to say as a human being, I am happy that it only says hamstring strain because that did not look great. So best of wishes to Tyrese Halliburton. Hopefully we can get him back on the floor because he's been so important for the Pacers in the league. It's going to be a very interesting stretch timing-wise for the Pacers, considering they are about to embark on a six-game road trip.
Great time.
And they are so they go at Atlanta, at Denver, at Utah. That Denver-Utah is a back-to-back, no fun. At Sacramento, at Portland, also a back-to-back, and then at Phoenix. So it's going to be an interesting time to see how much of the fort they can hold down, especially considering they are in that bunch of 4-8. Knicks are 22-15. Heat are 21-15. Pacers are 21-15. Cavs are 21-15. Magic are 21-16. So it'll be very interesting to see what happens. The one thing I will say with Indiana, with their pace, with their tempo, with their style of play, you may not have Halliburton, but you do have the ability to keep pressure on teams. So, and it is a little difficult to play some of these teams when the top guys are out. So we'll see how they respond to that. But most important thing is Halliburton avoided what it looked like.
Yeah, like it, we were watching that game live during the watch party. Again, hop into those Dunker Spot online watch parties with his friends. Did not look great. Glad that that is all what it was. The only thing I wanted to add quickly, as you mentioned, obviously going to be worse without Tyrese. But the offense does still score the top 10 rate with Tyrese off the floor this year. 126.4 offense rating with Tyrese on. The Pacers have the best offense / highest offensive rating in NBA history on the season. And with him on, that number's higher. With him off the floor this year, 118.7, which would be basically the equivalent of a ninth in the league. So still good. It is going to be different. So curious to see how they adjust without him for, I guess, prolonged adjacent amount of time. But we will see on that front.
Real quickly, on Golden State, what version of the Warriors will Chris Paul return to when he comes back? On Detroit, what does Jaden Ivey do during this stretch? Is this an opportunity for him to stretch his wings? Obviously, you want Cade to be all right, but does Jaden Ivey show something that can now help them continue to move forward in Detroit? And then with Poeltl, it's going to be interesting to see how the Raptors balance things. It's a little ironic that you finally got this roster. You get the context for Quickley. You get the context for Barrett. And then you lose the big, who just looked re-energized after this trade. And so can you refine some of that? You know, we've seen Thad at the five work. Can he refine some of the magic that got him to Toronto? Is this Jontay Porter hours? What do we see there?
Yeah, excited for Jontay. He's had some fun flashes since he's cracked Toronto's rotation with the injuries. But yeah, like even going back to last year, it's like, hey, we have these guards. We have Scottie, et cetera. Who's the big that's going to help tie us together? You get Jakob Poeltl, and then you lose Fred VanVleet in free agency. It's like, okay, wait, so who's the guard? And now you get Emmanuel Quickley, and now Poeltl's out. And it's like, who's the big? Can we get 3 weeks with Toronto and just give them the ecosystem so you can see what this looks like? I think it'd be a lot of fun for them. Glad Kate's all right.
Hold on, Nikias.
What's up?
Hold on. Are you ready?
What's up?
For a return of a new segment called Steve Discover Something That Would Have Annoyed Nikias If He Didn't Bring It Up.
Sure. What you got for us?
Shout out to Richie. Woj tweets, Kawhi Leonard has signed a contract extension with the Los Angeles Clippers. Woj also states, the Clippers extension talks with Paul George are ongoing. An organization continues to want to get both stars lined up on longer-term contracts, sources tell ESPN. For now, Leonard has agreed on a new deal in a season that he's been healthy and highly productive. I have no further details, but I will continue to refresh. But Kawhi Leonard will stay a Los Angeles Clipper.
Oh, well, shout out to you. Shout out to Richie. As I'm now seeing, like, the chat feature and where we're recording, like, appreciate both of y'all. Kawhi Leonard, you will remain a Los Angeles Clipper. Like, there was a little bit of, what's going on here heading into the season. Since he was extension eligible, with nothing came of it. And it's like, okay, this really does feel like the year the Clippers have to do something. Or Kawhi can decline the player option, I believe, and hit free agency. Paul George, same thing. If they're working out extensions on both now, like, that seems obviously very good. Paul George had an all-star caliber season. Not sure if he'll make it this year. Kawhi certainly has had an all-star caliber season. And if he's healthy, like, I think he's certainly going to make it. So getting those two guys in, I guess, attention then turns to, like, the other guards as we hit the offseason. Like, do you bring Russ back and do you bring Harden back? I'd imagine they would want to do so with both, with the season that both of those guys are having. James Harden has certainly stabilized this offense. He's been very good. Russell Westbrook has been fun off the bench. The defense has been a pleasant surprise for me when watching Clipper games. And you know how I felt about the Russ defense and how it oscillates throughout his career. So, like, that's been a fun part. Shout out to the Clippers. Shout out to Kawhi. I'm curious to see what these numbers are going to be like. how long is this deal? If this is going to be like a 4-year something, like, what does that look like? Wow.
I'll make sure I continue to hit. I'll make sure I continue to hit refresh as we continue to record. I think the biggest thing for me, you have a Clippers team that's rolling. You probably feel better with the James Harden fit. I'm sure hashtag age is going to be something that people bring up, but you're opening a window for this team. And you have Ballmer who wants to win. And they're opening a new arena. And they're all they all have California ties. So I don't know if this will be a pure pivot, so to say. So interesting to see how it moves on.
That makes sense. Wow. That is some fun breaking news on the podcast. You don't get that anywhere else. That's big fire. Wow. Look at the Clippers. And now we turn our attentions back to Toronto to see if there's going to be an extension worked out at all with Pascal Siakam, or if we're going to continue to get trade rumblings that don't lead to trade rumblings because he doesn't want to sign an extension anywhere else, and thus teams don't want to offer things to get Pascal Siakam in the building. But neither here nor there. Unless anything else has popped on Twitter over the past 15 seconds as I got through all of that, I think we can now transition into the mailbag section, which, again, I'll say thank you to those who sent in questions. Dunkerspot@yahoo.com is the place to be if you want to talk some basketball with us or send in some questions for us to talk through on the pod. So let's get this thing started off with a niche friend of the program who says, "Hi, Steve and Nikias. Hope you're doing well. Appreciate the refreshing lens you see and talk hoops through. This may be a tough question to answer on a pod and with there being a lot of nuance, but if possible, how would you balance implementing or teaching free flow within offense and how to be patient within an action? Obviously, it's generally a more prevalent problem in college, but it's still there a little bit in the NBA with overcoaching instead of letting guys read the defense. But there is also the flip side of teams stagnating because there's no purpose to their flow."
Is this the Nikias Duncan does not like college basketball question?
I don't think so, but I'll add that in for the bit. I'll lean into that. Because, buddy.
It's about teaching the principles. It's about building the base of what you're looking for offensively. And you're looking to give your players, give your team the information, but also allow for the freedom of what players may see or feel during the course of a game. So I think it's one of the things that you've had to track. If we're talking purely in the NBA, this used to be a league that was heavy on sets. And I don't want to say that as if they don't run them anymore, but it used to be, hey, you know, go back and watch a Dallas tape and you'll be able to hear Rick Carlisle with his hand out telling everyone to slow down and then calling out a play. And now you look at Rick Carlisle in Indiana and what he's doing with that team, the type of basketball that they play and the tempo and freedom they play with, that's a different dynamic. The game has just evolved in that way. You look at Mike Brown and what he used to be offensively and how he's continued to shape and mold things around Domantas Sabonis and De'Aaron Fox. The game has changed in that way. You look at Coach Tibbs in New York, and where the whole thing was, this man had one of the largest playbooks I'd ever seen in my life when I worked in the NBA, and everyone's talked about Tibbs offense, Tibbs offense, Tibbs offense. The Knicks have kind of figured that portion out, no? Yeah. So I kind of think that's just how the game has evolved in that sense. But getting back to the question and less on the rant, you're basically looking to connect the dots for your team offensively. And so it can be as simple as, what do we do when we push and nothing's immediately there? You know, I point to the Clippers, and one of the big changes for them, when they first got together in that first stretch, they get a stop. It felt like quick shot time for whoever had the ball in their hands. And now you look at the difference of, hey, we got multiple guys who can push. If we can get to James, he can push and get us into something. We can flow into a pick and roll, flow into a pin down. We can just play out of it. But you have to have, the guys have to know, okay, if we don't have anything, we're getting right to this. Swing it to the big or dribble handoff or let's play, let's keep pressure on them. That's a concept. And you kind of allow them the wiggle room to figure out which way they want to do it, depending on the flow, depending on the spacing, depending on who's where, because you can't map all that out. And I think that's the big thing in today's game is there's going to be those tempo plays, those pace plays. You have to let guys go that way. You got to teach guys what the timing looks like. And more importantly, the purpose, the why. Why are we running this? What is the purpose? What is the point? You know, if you're running elbow action, a lot of teams run it. Maybe the play is purely for the dribble handoff. You know, you hit the elbow, someone cuts off, we dribble handoff to the left side, two screens, Chicago action, whatever you want to call it. How many coaches are telling their guys, hey, that first cut is live? So can we maybe get a layup out of this because people aren't paying attention? That's not something you have to hammer home and now make that a call per se, but you just keep that in the back of their mind. Like, hey, yeah, this is what we want to run, but this is also there. Or if they're reading it, and you can also dribble handoff back this way. Like, there's different, you just have to give the options and let them know what the different triggers are. You know, you look at delay action, common set across the league. We bring it up, we play through our big who trail, and we can dribble handoff either side. Why are we doing that? What are we trying to open up? You know, does your big know the angles? Does your big know the purpose? Or is your big looking to break it off an attack? I mean, no disrespect, but you watch the Detroit Pistons, and 54% of the time that Jalen Duren gets it, that man is looking to attack one-on-one, which is fine as an option, but it can't be the default. Mm-hmm. I think one of the biggest things that coaches are leaning into is teaching guys when to cut, when to space, how to relocate. You look at sometimes you watch some of these sets where they just flow into, they end up in an empty corner action, then you rewind it, oh, that person cut out to create space because they knew what was coming next. So again, it's just connecting dots.
That's good stuff. That's good stuff. Not going to add too much more to that. I was just going to say to that question, like it's establishing what your foundation is. Like this is what we want to get to ideally. And from there, you have options to play out of that. So I think nailing what you want to start with, and then just in general, nailing what you want your spacing to be, I think makes it easier. Because based on what the defense is doing or what their primary like scheme is or something like that, if you're spaced in a certain way, you kind of know where the help is coming from. And it makes it easier to decide, okay, if we flow here, I know this guy can cut, remove that help. We now have more options to play out of. We get into more drive and kick sequences from there. So that was kind of my read on things, that Steve has nailed all of it already. So don't want to hang there too much longer.
I have more. Just tying it back to the question, as far as stagnation or being patient within an action, if you're running a specific action for a reason, you've got to showcase what the action is, but you also have to allow some wiggle room. You know, I know this ages me, but I go back to John Wall and the amount of times he called for a pin down for Bradley Beal, knowing he just wanted to reject and drive the other way because there was space. Got to let them know there are those opportunities. I think a lot of it depends on cutting. What does the cutting look like? You can tell by the cutting, okay, is this team just running this to run it, or are they running this to really execute and keep pressure on a defense? You know, I think one of the biggest changes in today's NBA is the combination of actions, misdirection, and the ability for teams to make a set look like it's one thing while really disguising what the true purpose of that is. And I think that's where you kind of are able to add the layers and get some of the buy-in where, okay, if we run this, run that, it looks like this, but this is what's really open. So that's pretty much it. And it also depends on your personnel. Yeah. Great movement is fantastic. I love movement, but movement does not always equal success. And you have to understand who you have as a team, because that set may look fantastic, but you may not have the big that can roll and pop, or you may not have the score that puts pressure on the defense or the shooting to make it a spacier type of beat. And a team can just be like, hey, that's cool. We're going to help off this guy and take this away. So Hopefully that was enough nuance for you.
Sounds pretty good to me. I would imagine that's plenty for Anish and the other dunkers to chew on. Next one is going to come from JP, who says, hello. How much of elite passing vision is learned versus inherent? Could a young player who has not yet shown passing skills at the professional level, if enough of his or her training time was dedicated to seeing the floor, become an above average passer? What would it take to make Cam Thomas average 7+ assists in a functional offense?
I do believe you can develop the eye for those type of plays in the same way that a quote-unquote non-shooter can improve that shot, in the same way that guys can understand when to take and make pull-ups. Those things can be developed. I do think a lot of it is based on repetition, and a lot of it is based on trajectory. And so, not the best example, but let's take a look at Tyrese Haliburton. And the way he started out in pick and roll with his aggression, his mindset when he had the drop, and finding a way to not only just mix in pull-ups, but also drive and make plays. Some of that was some of his natural instincts that he already had. But then the scoring continued to grow to the point where now you're having to throw different coverages at him. And now the passing can really pop. So it's kind of a give and take to a degree. if we take it away from Tyrese and go just like the typical young guard arc, like Damian Lillard's rise or pick a name out of a hat, there's usually a moment where that talent, that scoring ability, turns into more help defense or more aggressive pick and roll coverages. So if you have some of that playmaking stuff in you already, you have an opportunity to enhance it. If you are having to learn it, the defense will help you in the sense that we're not going to let you do that one thing you like to do a lot of. How are you going to figure it out otherwise? And that's where the repetitions come in, because you have to now learn and be able to see where the big is open, where's the help coming from. You got to develop the chemistry with your big man to know where they're going to be if you get two on the ball. Are they going to pop? Is it going to be a short roll? Are they going to continue their late roll? Is my wing going to pull up? Do I have a chance to fly it, skip it to the corner? You look at someone like Anthony Edwards, right? His playmaking growth has been fun. It's not perfect, but you can see the moments where he's slowing down a bit, understanding where the help is coming from and looking to make that play. And it's not automatic yet, but the more he does it, the better off he is. I think the more you can see it, the more natural it becomes. I look at Desmond Bane, right? Some of this is context, some of it's role, but his assists gone from 1.7 to 2.7 to 4.4 to 5.4. Anthony Simons, from 3.9 to 4.1 to 5.3. You probably still classify those guys as closer to scorers, right? But I think the volume of scoring that they do, the amount of on-ball reps that they have, and the way that defenses treat them can change things. But also, once you establish yourself in the league to a degree, it becomes easier knowing you're going to get the ball back. I think that's a key piece of it. If I know what my role is, I know I'm going to be involved, it's easier for me to draw defense in and kick and make a play versus I need to score to stay on the court. And if we're bringing it back to Cam Thomas, it's probably that difference. I think you probably feel better about the playmaking to a degree, but how much of that is he's also just playing more? And he knows he's going to play more, as opposed to, I got to get buckets to stay on the court. It's hard to make some of those plays when your mindset is, I need to score. And just tying it back, like, sometimes defenses don't cooperate with some of that stuff. Like, I look at CJ McCollum, and this is no disrespect, because CJ McCollum is a tremendous basketball player. With his blend of scoring and passing, you know, Nikias, I've been shocked that teams have just chosen drop for this amount of his career. But sometimes defenses just choose a poison. They'd be like, hey, this is what you got. This is what you deal with. Look at Tyler Hero's arc, right? He did enough scoring for teams to be like, nope, two on the ball for you, buddy. Kind of worked through some of that. And then you saw defenses say, actually, drop. Drop's fine. That's okay. Go ahead and make a few if you need to, but we're going to trust the space and stay out of rotation to take some of these plays away from you. Look at Phoenix playing the Clippers the other night with Bradley Beal, with Devin Booker, with Kevin Durant. They mixed some aggressive coverages at times, but otherwise it was, hey, here's this space. Do what you want with it. So I think that ties into it as well.
Yeah, I got you. And like, I'm glad you brought up the guard example, because my mind immediately went to some of the conversations we've had about Joel Embiid, in terms of what's learned and what's inherent, et cetera, and getting a bunch of reps. Think about how he's been able to play out of double teams. Him just seeing a ton and getting more reps against it helps, obviously. But then even back to the Philly episode we had, was it last season or the season before last, we had Jackson Frank on. He was talking about how intentional Philly was about particular spacing and how stat they appeared, but like how they made the reads easier for him. So I think there is kind of like this relationship between what you're seeing versus what your team context is that can help you get those reps and ultimately help you diagnose what defenses are doing, being able to map that out quicker. And then it just makes it harder for you to see some of the stuff that's getting thrown your way. And so like, even with the Hero point, like I'm glad you brought that up. Goes to the point, like you said, he played well enough to get a different coverage. And then those results were very hit or miss for him as he got that. And it's like, okay, let's dial this back. But I think now he has a better sense of, okay, when I do see this, I know when I need to come off of it now. And like, even now, he's as it's gone back to more drop for him. Like, you're starting to see the pacing even be better within drop. And he's trying to manipulate things through drop. So it's not just, I can just get to this pull-up or this floater. I can now try to manipulate a little bit more and see, okay, can I fit in this pocket pass a little bit more? So he's finding more, I guess, like finding more windows within that coverage and making that more intentable. And so maybe if that continues, we might get back to, okay, we need to get our big closer to the level now. Or we need to just hedge out or trap him now and see what he does from there. So it's really a fun combination there. But in terms of learned versus inherent, like I do think some of it is inherent. Like some people can just process things quicker than others. And I think that combined with the reps makes it a little bit easier for them to kind of fast track how quickly they can make those reads and how they can hurt defenses. But I would say the experience overall is going to take more precedence.
I think the point where you see the instinct is when you have guys who get the reps, but they start to predetermine their reads based on what they think is going to happen, as opposed to seeing it and letting it play out. So I'll add that to your point.
Okay. Good stuff. Good stuff. Next one is going to come from Josh, who says, longtime fan, big bounce embracer here. Really appreciate you guys and what you do. My question stems from me watching some Cholet games for so long. I noticed that parts that Cholet was picking up guys full court, but not trapping or pressing that aggressively. I'm giving them the credit that that was the scheme and not lacking execution from the players, which made me think it was about burning the shot clock. The University of Virginia also comes to mind with their packed line defense. All of that to ask, is there room in the NBA for those types of pace-slowing defenses as a strategic innovation? I know the Hayward era Jazz played slow with a purpose, but that felt more about them walking the ball up on offense and leaning into their bigs on defense than any sort of schematic emphasis. I think with the NBA shorter shot clock that someone would try to emphasize grinding down the clock and forcing bad shots. Is there just too much shot-making talent, or is doing that a hard sell for players?
Well, really good question. Much enjoyed. I enjoyed all of them, by the way. Usually I say thanks, but my fault. I forgot. Been locked in. I wouldn't even say it would be a strategic innovation. I mean, we see teams throw out token ball pressure to get you to start your offense later, initiate your set later. We'll see that more and more as the season goes on. I think you have teams that are comfortable controlling the tempo in the half court offensively to a degree. Like, I think my mind goes to the Lakers. My mind goes to the Rockets, where we want our defense to be a strength. If we can opportunistically push off misses or steals, we will do that. Otherwise, we're going to get stops. We're going to try and grind you a little bit on that end. We score. Now we're set up again, and we kind of keep you in a box that way. So I think it's a concept that will never leave, but you have to adjust it. My thought, the first thing I wrote down was, are you ready for the counters if you're going to sell out on that? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you want to go ahead and pressure the ball and try to make sure the clock lowers that way. Hey, a quick back screen or maybe a stagger or something in the backcourt. Now they're getting downhill. You have to shift and help in a different way. Are you prepared to live with that? How many reps of that can you take? I think as far as getting back to just the purely, hey, our defense is going to grind you down, you need the ball pressure. So you need activity. You need to be able to pressure and contain penetration, which has been an issue around the league. You need guys who are aware off ball and can deny, you know, an action or a movement to just disrupt the timing of a set to, again, also add some of the element of we're taking the clock away from you. But then again, are you ready for teams to counter with back cuts? So how much can you really dig into that consistently? And then if you're going to do that successfully, we have those two things in mind. You have to nail the coverage on whatever the first action they get to is. Because you can do all that work, you can get them later in the clock, but if you botch it, whether by, you know, over-helping on a roll or missing a switch or you're not quite at the level, they can hit you. And I think that part of it is what changes the math for me a little bit, to where you have to sustain such a higher level of defense in today's NBA than before, where, hey, we took away the first option of your set, now you're not sure where to go. We took away the second option, now you're fighting the clock. Offenses are typically starting earlier, and they're probably going to put you through multiple options. So you have to be ready for that. But if you can be physical, alter some of that movement, some of that timing, you can get a team deep in the shot clock. The question becomes, how many times can you do it? Can you do it over and over and over again? Especially, let's say you're not scoring on the other end. Now that team gets a rebound, they grab and go, they're back in tempo. they can quicken the pace very quickly and get right back to how they want to play. In my mind, I just think there are so many more teams playing with movement and so many more teams that could punish your breakdowns. Like we were watching Pistons Kings yesterday, and not Domantas Sabonis in, it's Alex Lynn in the game. And we see 3 to 4 handoffs with the ball moving side to side. That's different. Cleveland played San Antonio the other day. Then they just randomly, not even a call, pinned down for Max Strus. He didn't have it. He passes and cuts with Jared Allen. Nothing there. Jared Allen flows into a dribble handoff with Donovan Mitchell. That flows into stack pick and roll. They just flowed into all that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little bit different. Also, you have the teams that will just take quick shots. Like Orlando, Minnesota. Minnesota did a great job defensively against Orlando. Probably closer to what the vision of what this question may be as far as pressuring the ball, sliding under, making sure they switch when they need to, keeping the ball out of the paint. That kind of stuff to just keep everything in front and bog you down. That's probably the key right there. Mm-hmm. But there was one possession early. They ran one pick and roll. Jalen Suggs said enough and took a quick pull-up three. In my mind, I was like, yeah, you can try and bog them down, but they just may not cooperate. Mm-hmm. So that's what I had there.
It's really good stuff, sir. We appreciate you. Like, I echo your sentiments that these have been some really good questions that we got to go through so far. And I like this one. This one took me down. Well, got me close to a rabbit hole. Didn't want to go full rabbit hole because there's a whole bunch of stuff I can get into with this. But it brought me back to the defense conversation we had on the pod last year when we did our defense theme episode. And one of the things I brought up was like, hey, it feels like teams are trying to full court press thing a little bit more. They're trying to add more pressure in the backcourt and trying to slow teams down. And like the first name that came to mind there was like Jose Alvarado, because he obviously has like the fun sneak from behind steals. But just in general, he checks into the game, you inbound it, he's right there in your jersey. And he's just trying to make you work, et cetera. Like Javon Carter's another guy that would do it. When he was in Milwaukee, you can go on down the line with some Dennis Smith Jr. is another one. They had a lot of fun with that. And that encouraged me that year to kind of look up, okay, how often is this happening? Is this actually a trend or is this something that's just popping on my eye real quick? So went to Second Spectrum last year, and sure enough, the amount of times or the league average in terms of like full court pressure, it was up. And so I went back to that well this morning as I was going through that question. And I decided, okay, let's not do, because I think last year I did like the last 5 seasons, just to kind of give a brief little sample. I was like, all right, cool. The Second Spectrum database goes back to the 2013-14 season. Let's see what this looks like. So back in 2013-14, just in terms of a guy getting picked up in the backcourt, not even factoring in, is this actual pressure versus like the full pressure, just the high pickup point. That's about 16.8, roughly 17 possessions per game was your league average there. In terms of teams doing that, average length of a possession was 18 and a half seconds. You fast forward to this year, it's up to 22.2, actually a slight different last year because that was at 22.8 possessions per game. Average length of possession, about 17 and a half seconds. And then you look at the efficiency in that. In 2013-14, offenses, 1.03 points per possession. This year, 1.12 points per possession. It's so hard to, even if you just bring that token pressure, it's so hard to get a stop. Teams are breaking the plane faster. And to Steve's overall point, teams are also able to just flow into different things easier than they have in years past. And sometimes teams just don't cooperate. So you may get the quick shot and you're okay with, but you also may get the quick shot because someone stumbled dealing with a pick. And it's early pull up and it's good from a good shooter because you didn't handle it well. And so I did that and I was like, okay, cool. So that's just the high pickup point. What happens when you add in genuine ball pressure? Well, does that make any sort of difference? And it was sort of the same split because as I did this with just picking up guys, from 2013-14 to 2017-18, it was like steady increase. Like the efficiency wasn't great. And then 2018-19 happened. It was a big bump. And then from there, just gradual increase in teams trying to do it. And also the offense efficiency also rising with that. And it was a similar trend when I added in the ball pressure as well. Possessions lasted about 19 seconds in 2013-14, 1.01 points per possession. You fast forward to this year, average possession length is down to 17.6 seconds, 1.1 points per possession on those trips. And it's just like, you can't really, teams are trying to do it, but you can't really afford to with how good teams have gotten offensively, how much more spacing is there, how good these ball handlers are manipulating things. Like all it takes sometimes is just, I will set this screen 70 feet from the basket. You may turn me once with your ball pressure, but you try to turn me the second time, now you're running into something. And if your partner is like 10 feet away, because you're not trying to trap me 70 feet from the basket, I got space to kind of lead the dance. And if there's another screen behind that, or if there's a cut somewhere, some false action, now you're in trouble. And to Steve's point, now not only do you have to lean into your help principles, you have to do it from a different angle. You got to do it with even more distance, which the general distance that defenses have to cover now is why offenses are so tough to deal with league-wide. Now you extend that even more. You can't really afford to do it, to get back to the heart of the question. If you're going to add that, it kind of has to be the false pressure. Once you add the true ball pressure on top of it, unless you have Jose or Dennis or Drew, if you don't have him guarding 3 through 5, because he's been asked to guard a little bit of everyone at Boston, if you don't have one of those type guys, I just don't know if you can afford to genuinely press that button often. Because even if you do a good job, there's still so much room for your defense to break down. And then you just zoom out to the general energy effect. If we do this in the first quarter, how is this even going to look once we get midway through the second, early third, fourth quarter? Is my elite point of attack defender, who we're going to need in the last 5 minutes of this game, is he more tired than usual because we've been throwing out the pressure and it's got burned a couple times in the first half? Like, those kind of things build up. And even zooming out more than that, if we're just trying to establish this base early, what do these full court pressure looks look like in February compared to November? Can we afford to do this in the playoffs now that it's scouted and now they're throwing out even more wrinkles to when we try to go to this? I don't doubt that these are things that have been thought about. And again, we have seen a uptick in the regular season, at least in terms of this full court pressure, or the full court pickups and the full court pressure. We have seen that tick up. But like, as a wholesale, this is what we do type thing, I don't know if teams can afford to do so just because of where the league is offensively. There's so many things that offenses can do to kind of strain you. But I like the question. It's good stuff. It's really good stuff. All right, then. Next one's going to come from Rob, who says, hello. Hope you both are doing well and had a great holiday season. Thank you. New questions for y'all. Number one, how do teams determine when to move on from a player who is a high draft pick? Not going to name names, but there are several high-profile cases of high draft picks not getting their team options picked up or teams moving on from them early, generally, while others are still playing tons of minutes over other guys some might see as more deserving of their time. Is it just that the coach and front office have open dialogue about whether a player gets minutes or how many are mutually determined when they've seen enough? Who typically has the final say in these situations? So I guess technically a two-parter. But
it gets tricky. I think you're tracking the progress of the player. You're also tracking the progress of your team. And sometimes it can be as much as, we've given you this opportunity, we're not playing well, we need to pivot and go into a different direction, or we have someone else who kind of does some of the similar things or may play the same position and your role may be lessened or context has changed, either good or bad. You know, I kind of wish there was an example here. Did you have any examples that came to mind?
I feel like the early example for me was just, I guess we look at Sacramento with Bagley. You look at Golden State with Wiseman. In terms of the option not being picked up, I guess Jalen Smith with Phoenix. And then eventually ending up in Indiana. And like he's had a fun tenure in Indiana so far. Like, those are funny that all of those are bigs. But like, those are some of the examples that popped from my mind when I was going through the question. Does any of that help?
It does. I mean, like, for instance, we'll go context with Jalen. Was he ever going to get the opportunity to reach the heights that he's at now in Phoenix with that team that was specifically looking for, okay, we need to win a title? Mm-hmm. You know,
I doubt it.
The version of Aaron Nesmith that's in Indiana is probably something that Boston would have liked. Boston's timeline was a little bit different and they valued his shooting more. And so if the shooting wasn't there, we have other options. So could he have truly developed? You know, and sometimes you're a guy who gets drafted in the lottery and, you know, let's go to New Orleans. Lewis Jr., right? Mm-hmm. Has he done something horrifically wrong? Don't answer that, Pelicans fans. I wouldn't say so. Right? But you look at the options you have. We have CJ. We have Alvarado. Dyson could do some of the playmaking stuff. We're trying to find ways to play all these wings, you end up getting squeezed sometimes. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily his fault, but you counter that with Cole Anthony, right? Cole Anthony, playing well, played well, context changed. We got Paolo. We got Franz. You kind of got to shift to a different role. Doesn't mean that they don't want him there. You just got to go into a different box.
I think the under-discussed portion of like this particular thing is the fact that guys in future draft classes can change the map for you. And I'm glad you brought up Kyra Lewis Jr. Because like I was someone who, again, not a draft Nick, but like doing the catch-up and looking at Summer League and then just in general having the type of guard he is in my mind. I was like, oh, this seems like a fun fit for New Orleans. I'd like to see him get some burn. And you get the early rookie struggles because it's hard to be a good guard in the NBA very early on. And then you add more talent. You eventually trade for CJ. And it's like, oh, well, this is kind of unfortunate. He's not really going to get the burn here. And so I think we're probably entering year two or the second year in a row where if New Orleans is going to do anything trade-wise, I'm sure Kyra's name is going to come up as like young flyer that Team X may want to acquire along with whatever salary. And now we get to see what kind of burn Kyra can get, what kind of opportunity he can get. Like, to your point, it's not his fault. Like, I still think he can be a solid guard in the NBA. It's unfortunate. Davion Mitchell, I think we're starting to see a little bit of this in Sacramento. Knew what he provided. Knew what the shortcomings were offensively. Sacramento's really freaking good. If the shot was worse than usual, here comes Keon Ellis. And it's like, oh, well, now what? And then you add in what Malik Monk has done with Sacramento for a season and a half now. De'Aaron Fox turning into a fringe MVP candidate. Like, okay, what runway is he going to get now? And so now we fast forward to the Pascal Siakam talks that were the grand opening, grand closing talks with Toronto. Package is going to probably include Harrison Barnes, Kevin Huerter, Davion Mitchell. Because, not because he's awful and will never be a successful NBA player. It's more, okay, we need this because we're this good. And if you're not going to be able to provide that for us, we need to move you for someone who can in a different box. And so, like, it gets kind of tough for players like that. And I would imagine, someone that hasn't worked for a team, like, I would imagine it's kind of coach and front office having that dialogue. Like, okay, I like this guy. I don't know if he can help us right now for teams that are in more to win now situations. This is kind of what we need. And then it's also from the front office, listening to your coach and then looking at the market. Like, okay, this guy might be coming up. It's restricted free agency time. We have to allocate a certain amount of resources here. Can we afford to give this guy 460 or whatever? Versus let's make a trade now and get a vet in the building. Or let's do something else in free agency, not worry about his playing time. Let's just do something else. Like, I would imagine that conversation or those conversations have to be had. I don't know. Like, the runway that guys get are going to depend on, to be frank about what their draft slot was, but also just where the team is right now. I think it's easier to make the argument, okay, this young guy hasn't been good. Efficiency numbers are bad, advanced numbers are bad, whatever, whatever. Easier to give that guy extended runway when we are still in a bad place and we can afford to really search out, okay, will this happen at all or not? With all due respect, like, I think if Detroit was better, Killian Hayes probably would be somewhere else by now versus still getting the opportunity to showcase, okay, can we get something with the shooting? Can we get something with the driving to complement what he does as a passer, as a defender? He gets more run in Detroit because they're still not close to being there yet. I think if Killian had this exact arc in OKC, I don't think he would be there just because of how they accelerate, how they're able to build it out, who they drafted, who they brought into the room, et cetera, et cetera. I think we're eventually going to get to that point. Like, how many minutes is Trey Mann getting in OKC? How many minutes is Poku getting in OKC? Now that Chet's in the room, et cetera, et cetera. So, like, you're even starting to see some of that there. So, I think that's my spiel on it.
It's a really callous thing to say and a callous way to say it, but sometimes in the business, you give people an idea. Hey, we like what you do. This guy's available. We can get that from there. We appreciate you. Just a thought.
Yeah. It gets tough. All right. Next question going to come from Jacob, who says, hey, guys. Hello. Thanks for all these great mailbag segments. Always a fun listen. I was thinking about PJ Tucker and how he might fit on a different playoff team if he leaves LA. And it got me thinking about how he's been defended and how teams defend other non-shooting wings. I feel like teams used to hide their worst defender, usually a point guard, And now teams are using non-shooters to stash a big, to switch other actions to let rim protector play more center field. Do you feel like that's a trend, especially as teams switch more, or is it a team-by-team thing?
I think the trick with putting your point guard on a non-shooter is, depending on the personnel, it just opened things up for the offense to use that person as a screener. And now the whole idea is to take away the impact they have because they're spaced, and now they have more impact offensively because that point guard or whoever's guarding that non-shooter, you may not want to be guarding player X, who's very good with the ball in their hand. Mm-hmm. And the second part is they're no longer spaced, so they're involved in the action. So all the people that they want spaced are also, you know, out where they need to be. So offenses can flip it on you that way. Mm-hmm. I think the benefit of putting your big on a non-shooter is you have the reps of what you want to do if a team wants to go to pick and roll. But you also have the benefit of allowing them to roam and help more. And so I think it's mainly on offenses when that happened to get creative with how they use the non-shooter. Can you mm-hmm. space them on the wing and make that rotation different? Can you put them in the action to kind of keep it similar or try and disguise some things? But if you're a defense, you can basically take the things that an offense wants to do and we force you to do something different, use someone else as a screener, or we can dictate terms with our help. I think that's just one of the ways that defenses can bend offenses to a degree. Now, the biggest part is how effective can it be? How much do you want to mix it in? I mean, we've even seen that with Denver and Jokic. Well, they'll just put him on, quote-unquote, non-shooter and mm-hmm. let him roam just to give a different look. So I think it's something that trend may be strong, but it's something you're definitely going to keep seeing mm-hmm. In today's game, especially just as you continue to try and to find ways to slow offenses down.
Got you. Yeah, just to quickly just answer the question, like, it's felt more team by team for me than like a general league-wide trend. Like, I do think it's going to get that way as teams bolster their personnel, or as the league itself gets, you know, continues to more heavily invest and like wings and being more switchable. I think you can kind of play around with matchups more in that way. But like Boston seems to be like king of this, in which we're flipping all these matchups. And even that's a big personnel deal. Like before Kristaps, you had Robert Williams, and that shift to, okay, you guard this non-shooting wing. Let's keep you near the rim. But because they had Marcus Smart and now Drew Holiday, if we're going to like Kristaps this year, but because you had those kind of guys at the point of attack, Derek White, you have Jason Tatum, who's huge. You can put him just about anywhere. Jaylen Brown is a strong on-ball defender. You can switch him 1-3, sometimes 1-4, depending on who that four is. Because of that, you have the leeway to just put your center anywhere. Like, I think there are a lot of teams that would like to do it more, but don't have the personnel to really do that. Like, how often have we seen, just thinking of Atlanta very briefly, how often have we seen, like, Clint on non-shooting wing over the past couple of years?
The personnel point is a great one. I think the other tie-in is some teams just aren't good enough defensively to do it. Mm-hmm. We can't get to defense 102 if we haven't passed defense 101. So while there may be value for them in a playoff series, they got to get right defensively overall. Mm-hmm. So we can't even get to the trickeration. We're still working on our base.
Yeah.
I think the personnel point is very, very key, and I like it. But I think some teams just are not at that level defensively to be able to execute and experiment with that on a night-to-night basis when they're just trying to get right.
Yeah. Appreciate the question, Jacob. Let's now move to Keith, who has a three-pack for us, who says, I discovered dunksandthrees.com today, and in browsing the leaders in all these stats, I saw that New York's own Isaiah Hartenstein is leading the NBA in defensive estimated plus-minus, which is surprising considering the expected drop-off from Mitchell Robinson and the Knicks' defensive drop-off since the Mitch injury. 16th in defensive rating, 28th in the last 15 games at the time of the email. I had three-ish questions all related to how teams evaluate and value different center profiles. Number one, obviously a longer sample would be nice, but how do teams determine if a player can sustain a level of production after scaling his minutes up? This is an interesting one. Like, this is something that I haven't thought about. Like, how, I guess, like, what's the threshold point to, okay, this guy can just do this. Like, would that be, I'll toss that to you. Like, instead, just we see this in practice and now he's doing it, we just believe that he can continue to do it? Or are there like certain benchmarks that teams, coaches, et cetera, are looking for to kind of determine this is sustainable versus what isn't?
What would the benchmark be? That's my question.
I guess maybe it'd be something like just coverage specific.
It would vary team by team. It would vary by what you're trying to do and what you're trying to get them to do. Mm-hmm. If you're a team that plays two on the ball or a more aggressive pick and roll scheme naturally, if they're good at that, then you probably feel better about it. But, okay, you've done a great job in drop. Now we have to play point guard X. Can you now come to the level? So it's a buildup to where, hey, we know what you can do. You're doing this pretty well. Can you adjust and add some versatility to it? Oh, you can. That's even better. It sounds basic, but the more that they do it, the more that you believe in it. There's something to be said about just consistency. And if you're sitting there in the coaches meeting and we know the effort is going to be there, we know that you understand what your role is, what your job is, what you have to do. The positives keep showing up. So, you know, you're nailing your help on the weak side. You're communicating. You're, you know, in Hartenstein's example, you're in a drop. You're getting through it. It's not an issue. On top of everything that you normally do, continuing to show up, whether it's rebounding, passing, cutting, whatever it is, you can tend to live with the negatives. Like now my mind goes back to when I was in Brooklyn and Brooke was out and Mason Plumlee had to start. And it was like, okay, Mace, this is, you got a big opportunity. This is your chance. And he nailed it. And so you end up with a guy that plays their way into the opportunity for us to believe in it until it goes away. It's always in the back of your brain. At some point, this could go left, or hey, maybe the team start hitting the drop or they start scouting and doing different things. But if they've done the job, you just continue to believe in them to do the job and you continue to encourage them and continue to teach them on how they can even get better at it. Because the more you have success, the more they have success, the more buy-in you'll get, and the more they can just grow in a way that you didn't expect. Sometimes it can be as simple as knowing as a player that you have that opportunity. That might bring a higher level of focus and effort, knowing that you're going to get the reps. You're not living and breathing on every single possession to a degree, mm-hmm. to where I know, darn, I messed this up. I'm about to get, you know, pulled or whatever. There's freedom there. Where, hey, you messed one up. Hey, you might get it back. So that was my first thought.
Okay. Got you. And then the second question, does Ihart become more valuable than Mitch if he can rebound or defend at Mitch-ish levels while providing more offensive spacing and creativity and elbow action? Well, I would quickly say, like, if all of those things are true, then I think yes, just because in terms of just what you can do with the ball in his hands compared to Mitch, like, that just adds a different dimension to the offense. And I think that he can, it's in a different way, but, like, he can accentuate what Jalen Brunson does and what some of the other guards do in a way that Mitchell Robinson can't, because he's just not that kind of hub. It opens up the cuts in a way. The cuts become more alive with Isaiah Hartenstein in versus Mitchell Robinson. But a secondary thought would be, though, like, it would be kind of like, I don't know if trade-off is the right word, but, like, I'm thinking about what Mitchell Robinson brings as a role/vertical threat that Isaiah doesn't. And I think about the overall offensive rebounding edge that Mitchell Robinson gave the Knicks while he was in. And so I was quickly trying to get this filtered up, like, what is New York's offensive rebound rate since Mitchell Robinson's been out? They're seventh since December 11th. And this was a team that was, like, one or two throughout the, you know, the early portion of the season before Mitchell Robinson went down. And so, like, would you take the dip in the extra possessions versus adding more variety into the offense? Like, that's a trade-off I think is worth discussing. To the defense point, Isaiah's been much better than I think a lot of people expected, like, individually. But he also just isn't the presence that Mitchell Robinson is. Overall, he isn't the rebounder that Mitchell Robinson is. So I guess, like, overall, like, again, if all of those things happen, yes. I just don't think we're at that point to say that he's just firmly better, more valuable, full sail, moving forward, et cetera. I think it's a good thing that you can even ask this question based on what he's been able to do and some of the stuff he's been able to open up. I don't know if I'm quite there just firmly, yeah, he's just better than Mitch and you can afford to move on, et cetera.
Do you copy and paste this to Orlando with Goga and Wendell Carter Jr.?
Ah, I see. I would say, yeah, like I think you appreciate what Goga's done. Like, I think you want to get a larger sample in with Goga in general. And then also see, like, what you can work in with Wendell. Like, I don't think I've seen enough from either this year to be like, okay, now it's time to just change things at center. Goga's the answer. Let's move Wendell for stuff. I think it's too early to get there. At least for me, it's too early for me to get there.
Okay. Do you copy and paste this with number two in defensive EPM, Xavier Tillman and Steven Adams?
What a good basketball player, that Xavier Tillman. But anyway, I don't think you move on from Steven Adams. Not yet, anyway.
Okay. More valuable than Mitch? I don't think so. I do think it would increase Hartenstein's value to the team as far as just the base of who you are. You feel more comfortable with what he can do. You might extend his minutes. You might close with him on certain nights because of this experience that you have here. For me, it goes back to just having a really good 1-2 punch, a little bit of fire and ice, to where we know our defense can stay the same or we won't have as much wiggle room, even if these two are very different players offensively and they give us different positives on that end. If we feel stable about our defense throughout and we can stay consistent with our defense throughout, that elevates our team. So that's where my mind went.
Got you. And just a quickly update. Again, seventh in offensive rating since the Mitchell seventh in offensive rebound rate, excuse me, since the Mitchell Robinson injury. They were indeed first through December 10th before Mitchell Robinson went down. No, they were kind of fluctuating with a couple other teams within that stretch, but they end up at number one once you just filter for that date. So I wanted to clear that up very quickly. And then the third question, which I kind of answered, but anyway, third question, is it feasible to pay I Hart this offseason / could he be a better fit with the next version of the Knicks? I guess to that point, like, honestly, yeah, I would say I would try to bring him back unless some team really just breaks the bank with him. But, like, ultimately, like, would you envision Isaiah Hartenstein getting, like, $20 million a year from someone? I kind of view him as, like, mid-level exception or slightly above whatever the mid-level exception number is going to be next year. And I think if you're in that range, like, I'd just probably bring him back just because he is good for you. You have been able to, he an individual, I think he's held up defensively a little bit better than most anticipated. And the offense stuff is fun. If it does get to, like, 20, 21, even if it's, like, a 2-year 40 or something like that, or 360 or something. Like, I think once you get 20, like, that's probably where you're like, nah, I don't think you can do that because you're also worried about, like, future tax stuff and things like that. But if it's reasonable, I say you bring them in. As far as better fit with the next version of the Knicks, maybe, but then I still go back to just the general deterrence and rebounding presence that Mitchell Robinson provides. Like, it's kind of hard to escape that portion of it. Especially if you're keeping, well, yeah, like, I think the defense is still just going to be too important. Like, Mitchell Robinson was defending at a legit, like, all defense level before he went down. And so, like, I was about to go into, like, again, the fit with the guards, but also, like, it may be a little bit easier to play him and Julius together because you can use Isaiah higher up on the floor as a hub and stuff. And, like, the Mitchell-Julius thing was a little bit of a clunky fit offensively, but still, the offensive rebound, you kind of counteract some of that. And then defensively, it's just a different level of, like, fear factor for opposing offenses, so. Could be better with the next version, but I'll probably still lean no.
Gotcha. I said you want to bring him back unless someone throws him a bag because he's really important to your team, that second unit. But other than that, hey, Nikias.
What's up?
Quick return to a segment called Steve Sees Something that Nikias would be bothered by.
Okay.
One or two. I'll give you a choice. One or two. Which one would you like?
Let's go two.
The Seattle Seahawks, no longer coached by Pete Carroll. He will remain with the organization as an advisor.
Huh. That's interesting.
I mean, would you like to know one?
Sure. What we got?
Clipper star Kawhi Leonard signed a 3-year, $153 million contract extension. Deal includes 52 in first year and approximately $50 million a season over the next 2 years. Sources tell ESPN that is per Adrian Wojnarowski.
No player option. Just locking it in. Okay. Is that fully guaranteed? Do we have like partial guarantee last year? We don't know any of that stuff.
I told you what I knew, Big Dog.
Okay. My apologies. <father. clears throat> I would just say very quickly on the Pete Carroll front, surely there may be a coaching opening in an old stomping ground soon. So just we'll see. Wishful thinking, but we'll just keep an eye on it. Anyway, thank you for the news update, good sir. Next, I'm going to come from J.A., who says, gentlemen, greetings from Basula. Go Grizz, in parentheses, the real Grizz. Can't believe that great name is being wasted in the NBA on a part of the continent that never had the big ones. Side note, I hiked with a UCC minister a couple decades ago who told me I have a respect for grizzly bears that borders on sheer terror. Appropriate. Never envisioned reading those words on the Dunkerspot podcast. Okay. I didn't bother watching Orlando last year, but am enjoying them this year. Can you school me up on Paolo? What you like, what he needs to work on, changes year over last, ceiling, is he potentially good enough to be a team's lead creator at a playoff level? I found myself watching Paolo last night against Denver and trying to think of other teams whose lead scorer creator is a four and didn't really succeed. Kawhi maybe? Who am I missing? How does a scoring four challenge defenses? So first and foremost, all the Orlando talk we did last year, you didn't want to tune in. You didn't want to catch not one Bobo second quarter. Nothing with the fun with Franz, and Paolo was the rookie of the year last year. We didn't tap into any of the. I did a bad job of selling Orlando. Brought them up with multiple big guests we had on the pod last season. I feel like I have failed as a Orlando Magic enjoyer. I must go harder in 2024. Anyway, brief overview of Paolo. That man is one big, powerful, skilled four who get downhill, get to the free throw line. You will feel it after you play him. The mid-range game is fun. You want the efficiency to be better, but he's still growing. The playmaking has grown. If you want to think, I guess biggest shift for me from year one to year two, it does feel like the playmaking has popped a little bit more for him. And that's somewhat reflected in the assist numbers going up. But it does feel like he's mapping the floor out a little bit quicker and just overall better than he did last season. So like that'd probably be the biggest change for me. He is shooting the ball better. 3-point percentage shot up, but he's not taking a lot of threes still. His 3-point rate is actually down from last year. And so if we're thinking about like potential like growth areas for him, it's going to be not just the shooting ability, but the willingness to shoot. Like Steve and I have talked earlier in the year about, okay, he'll get these catch-and-shoot opportunities, and it feels like there's a bit of a hitch. There's a bit of do I really want to take this? He passes up some to get into some of those drives because he's so good at getting downhill. And I think in terms of his individual development and also just the prospect of playing off of Paolo or playing off someone else, he does need to become a better slash more willing catch-and-shoot option for Orlando to really help the spacing out or to help the shooting portion of it out, rather. Defensively, like he's felt fine to me. He had some fun flashes as like a rim protector or just a shot contester at the paint last season. Big body. You can switch him. I'll still worry about him against quicker guys. But I think he's really good. And to the general teams with a lead scorer or creator as a four, like the first name that came to mind for me was LeBron. If he counts, like I don't want to get into full position minutia on the pod. Lord knows we don't need version 974 of that on the podcast. But like LeBron came to mind. If you want to go lower level, like lead scorer, I guess Jeremy Grant in Portland would count. I mean, there are some fours that are leaned on to score. I don't think it's just Paolo. Kawhi would also count. So it's a good nod there. I think KD technically starting at the four, so he would also count as lead scorer slash creator in Phoenix. Your thoughts on Paolo, sir?
I think he's handling the responsibilities he has on this team in a way that I don't know if he gets enough credit for. The versatility that he's displayed, his on-ball work, the drives, obviously, something that popped very early. The self-creation has continued to grow as he just takes what defenses are giving him and now takes that into, I'm going to get to my spot and shoot. I'm going to find my areas to, you know, hit you, also use my footwork. Get in the paint. He just plays at really good pace, really good control for the most part. It's hard to really speed him up too much. I just like that he's developing that idea of finding his own spots and getting to where he wants to go. I like the development of the pull-up, especially for him with the drive that he has and how he can use that as a counter. The playmaking has grown as he's gone on. especially as more defenses show help. At some point this year, he was hovering around 40.6% on catch and shoot threes, which caught my eye because that's a lot better than 33.8 last year. If we're talking about growth, it's just his is going to be the natural growth of the Magic as far as dealing with switches, dealing with unders, dealing with the packed paint, dealing with when and where to attack in the half court in certain situations. They're kind of in learning how to win mode, which is a good sign for this team. It's a compliment for this team that they're already at this stage. You know, you talk about lead fours and scorers creators. I do think you have to widen it out with Orlando to a degree because they do have a little bit more of a unique setup with Franz and Paolo together. Because I don't know how much it would just be Paolo if they only had one of them. So you can kind of see the shift and you can see how important he is with Franz being down. I just think the amount of offense that those two can create on their own in pick and roll, in handoffs, post-ups, the Magic have leaned into that and embraced that to a different degree than most teams and are building around that. It's why Anthony Black works in those lineups. It's why Fultz works in those lineups. It's why Cole Anthony has more room to operate on the bench and be a scorer and be himself as opposed to, hey, do all the point guard stuff. It's why Jalen Suggs is able to have some of this leap because, hey, we just need you to do X, Y, and Z. These guys can handle the most of that. So I think long-term, it's more about building a roster that complements them and their skill sets. Do you have shooting? Do you have spacing? Do you have defense? You have bigs who can do multiple things. It's just building the boat that way.
Gotcha. And then just very quickly on the Paolo front, over his last 10 games, 29 points, basically 29, 8, and 6. While shooting 38% from three on over five attempts and getting to the line 10 times a game, he's been insane. He's had some really big performances as of late. So just a general shout out to Paolo, who I believe is going to be an all-star reserve this year. Just wanted to give him some praise. Quickly, as we have another Paolo question from Justin, who says, hey, Nikias and Steve, I want to start off by saying I love the show and all the work you guys do. Recently in a group chat of mine, it's become a discussion of who's better between Paolo and Chet Holmgren. And one of your guys' thoughts. Personally, I lean Paolo because I value offensive creation and the ability to bend defenses, giving your teammates advantages. Where do you guys land?
This one has Nikias stamped all over it, buddy. So go ahead.
Boy, does it. This may shock you to those who have been long-term listeners of the pod, but this had me in a headlock. Because I am generally a fan of big wing who can do driving and playmaking things and can be an offensive hub, I am also a fan of versatile big man who can protect the rim and also shoot and also drive and can also do some hub things, all of which Chet Holmgren can do. I probably lean towards... I probably lean towards Chet right now because of the defense. Like, he does have the general, like, efficiency gap, and it is rather large. But, like, obviously that is context dependent in terms of what the role is and also just what the personnel is. He does have the opportunity to play off of Shea. And OKC, to the time of the recording, has been an elite shooting team. The Orlando Magic, as much as I have, you know, early in the year praised their actual spacing principles and how they try to deal with that, Orlando is not a good shooting team. And so even with all the good things that Paolo does within his context, he is a bit hindered by his context. And I just mentioned 29, 8, and 6 over his last 10 and what he's been able to do there within that context and dealing with injuries on top of all that stuff. So, like, I lean Chet just because he has been incredible defensively in addition to, and as we talked about in the rookie report, it's not just him being spoon-fed shots and hitting stuff. Like, the self-creation burden has grown for him as the season's gone on. He has been legitimately good at it. He does pose mismatches of his own at the five spot because of everything that he can do there. And so the two-way impact for me is probably where I give, like, the slight lean to Chet. I think this is a fun discussion, though. And it was a fun slash headlock-inducing discussion for me because it's, like, two of my favorite ideal slash player archetypes facing off against each other. It's like, oh, yes, but also to both sides. But I guess I, like, 52-48 Chet. But I don't think it's a Chet, no questions asked or anything like that. But I probably lean Chet right now. What say you?
It's an interesting question. For me, it was just, I think they're both in great context to impact their specific teams and also grow to the best of their abilities. I kind of tried to simplify it. And I was like, is this as simple as if they just traded spots? What would it look like? I'd give Chet the edge defensively and shooting wise. I do, again, think the role Paolo has and how quickly he's grown into that kind of responsibility goes under the radar. So for me, I would probably lean Paolo right now. But it's very close. I think Chet's very good.
That's fair. That's fair. All right. Last one going to come from Jabril, which interesting considering like the Clippers news that got sprinkled in throughout the pod. But he says, hey, Nikias and Steve, since the Clippers have already given away 90% of the trade assets they have, why shouldn't they quadruple down post-Harden trade by trading Paul George and Bones in their last first round pick and however many seconds it takes to Phoenix for Kevin Durant? Wouldn't PG and Bones combined scoring be greater for Phoenix than just KD alone? I think Bones plus Eric Gordon would instantly stabilize Phoenix's bench. Which team would say no first? What are your thoughts?
All of them. All of them would say no first. The Suns did all that to get Kevin Durant and then just added Bradley Beal. No, they're not pivoting. We are all in. We're going to figure this out. And the Clippers just got James Harden and just re-signed Kawhi. So no, we're not messing with that. We're rolling. We're better than them. Why am I touching this? No disrespect. It's going to come off harsh. But nah, everybody says no.
Okay. Like, I am with you that both teams would say no. And that was my initial thought. And so my secondary thought was like, okay, let's go literal who would say no first. Who would have a stronger no? Who has the capital N and then no? And who has just the straight lowercase no? Or maybe they just say nah instead of no. The Suns.
The Suns say Noah.
Oh, God. You know what? That is a tremendous shot. Also a wild shot. Because I guess for me, like, is Bone, like, I won't even say, like, I'm not going to completely rule out like Bones plus Eric Gordon being a fun bench unit. I don't think that solves the fundamental issues with Phoenix right now. Like Paul George, a better perimeter defender at the very least, if not just flat out better defender than Kevin Durant is. I think that's fair. Paul George, if not a better shooter than Kevin Durant, is certainly a more willing three-point shooter and a more willing pull-up three-point shooter. So if you're looking at the overall, like Phoenix needs to get more threes up. With their offensive, you know, their offensive profile and stuff, like there are arguments to be made. Within a playoff context, though, like, does Paul George really solve the 3-point or rim issue to that degree to where you feel okay with it? And is Bones a playoff player yet? He could be. Like, I think he has the potential to be. And I think his scoring could pop in a playoff setting. But like, what evidence do I have that you could get that now? I don't know. Like, I think both teams say, no, it's probably more enticing for the Clippers than it is for the Suns, would be my read. I guess I'll also go to Suns say no. And that's before getting into the, we did all this for KD. And everything they had to deal with there. But fun thought exercise, though. I like it. Any free throws for you?
I have some.
Okay.
Do you have some?
I do not.
Okay. Who's more upset? KD with the media or Darko with the refs?
It's Darko in 4 for me. That man cut an entire promo after that game. I understand. Yeah. He is very upset with the way that went. He meant that.
Had his team's back. That's big buy-in. Secondary question. Who's going to be more upset? Darko with the refs or whoever Darko has to explain to about that fine?
Oh, boy. I think it's still going to be Darko with the refs. That man said they need to win today. If so, just let us know. We're going to show up. Oh, my goodness. What a time.
All right. So, Nikias, the NBA, Netflix, collabing on a new show, featuring 5 NBA players. Can you power rank your excitement level of the 5 players involved?
Ooh. downright the excitement.
Yeah, your excitement level, because we're just going to go ahead and talk about it real quick. I'm trying to pull up the tweet. I'm scrolling anonymously. LeBron James, Jason Tatum, Jimmy Butler, Anthony Edwards, and DeMontis Sabonis, new NBA documentary series. They will be the first ones for the project. You said this is neat, but you also had one question, LOL, and then got accused of tweeting like the Riddler. So...
We can talk about it a little bit. That's fine. That's fine. Ranking the excitement is probably Jimmy Sabonis, Bron, Ant, Tatum. And so my question.
So it's fourth quarter. Why is Tatum in?
Like my question was like, what are we going to get out of Jason Tatum content? Because as good of a basketball player, like I just like, he's not the most open star in the league, which is fine. Like I found it weird when people just poking, like I get the Kawhi jokes, but like I also feel weird when people just get like legit upset about how he handles media stuff and stuff. Like, no, if he wants to do that, it's fine. Same thing with Jokic. Like the jokes can be funny, but also leave people alone. So Tatum does feel like he doesn't super give much. And I think the most we've really gotten out of the Tatum stuff or just non-basketball stuff with Tatum, it's Deuce and it's the Kobe connection, which is also basketball related. And so for me, it's just like, okay, what exactly are we getting out of Jason Tatum out of this? What are we going to learn from Jason Tatum? Will he really cooperate with this? And will we learn some new stuff? So like in terms of excitement level, I'm just like, I don't really expect much out of this outside of he's really good and he works hard, which is important.
Hey.
But that doesn't register super high on the entertainment scale for me.
This might open you up to a new portal of Jason Tatum. Also, secondary question. Did it matter who they got once LeBron said yes?
No. Like, you're just printing money at that point.
There we go. All right. Speaking of Sabonis, 30-point triple-double while shooting 75% from the field against the Pistons, first king to do it in history. Why is his season being slept on?
Golden State Warriors first-round tax. Also, De'Aaron Fox playing like an MVP. And also, okay. Like, the Kings being bad when Fox was out while Sabonis was putting up good numbers.
Okay. What's funnier, LeBron saying Christian Wood only cares about a bucket or Christian Wood agreeing saying I do love my buckets?
It's the latter. I respect the self-awareness.
I believe OG Anunoby is a +111 in his first 5 games as a Knick. What will annoy people more? Defensive player of the year talk, all defense talk, or most improved player talk?
Ooh, that's a good one. I think, it's probably, honestly, it's going to be defensive player of the year talk. If that actually becomes the thing. Because I think that angers like multiple fan bases. Because I think with any of these three, Toronto fans is going to be upset. Like, he's been doing this, et cetera, et cetera. If we get Depoy and now you got Minnesota, like, wait, y'all don't see Rudy? And Laker fans like, hey, y'all don't see Anthony Davis? What in the New York tax is this in addition to the Toronto stuff? I think Depoy would probably be the one that does it.
Dang, you didn't even talk about Miami Heat fans or Bam. That's crazy. More likely to upset. Sneak into the... You didn't say it, though. More likely to sneak into the 3 seed, the Knicks or the Heat?
We're about to make this up right now. The Miami Heat.
Okay. Who do you believe in more, the Kings or the Pelicans?
Oh. I ain't gonna hold you. It might be the Pelicans. That scares me, though.
All right. Okay.
But
that defense. Who do you believe in more? The defense is legit. Who do you believe in more, Dallas or Houston?
Oh. Well, I guess Dallas by default because they got Luka, but like also Dallas has a big problem. Derogatory.
Okay. Who do you believe in more, Phoenix or the Lakers?
Prob. Oh man, but Lakers in seven?
All right. Who needs the one seed more, Boston or Minnesota?
Minnesota, I think, needs the one seed more.
All right. That concludes my free throws. Hit the horns.
Okay. Well, let's get on out of here. I'm prepared to get yelled at over the weekend. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Dunker Spot. If you haven't already, please subscribe. We are on Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. Also, we are on JJ Redick's YouTube channel every Tuesday. That is every Tuesday. That is every Tuesday. So if you haven't subscribed to his YouTube channel and you prefer watching pods versus listening to them, subscribe to JJ Redick's YouTube channel. We'll be there every Tuesday. Also, just general, a whole lot of good content on the channel sprinkled in throughout the week. You can follow me on Twitter at NikiasNBA. You can follow Steve on Twitter at SteveJones20. Join the Dunker Spot community on Twitter. We're having fun discussions in there. Join us for our online Dunker Spot watch parties. If you have a League Pass subscription / cable subscription, you can get in there and watch basketball games with us live. We're breaking things down live. If we have some end of game fun, some overtime stuff, Steve and I are going through clips. Steve does a tremendous job of breaking down what worked or what didn't work and the why behind it. So if you want to learn about basketball, also just have fun, very inclusive, a wholesome community. We just talk about life sometimes. It gets deep in there, gets heavy in there sometimes, but it's a good time. If you want to rock with us, the link to the room should be hyperlinked in your podcast description. Just click on that, enter your information. It is free, no shenanigans. And if it's not hyperlinked, then just copy and paste that link into your browser. Once again, it is free, no shenanigans. And with that, we will catch y'all next week.
Bye.